Hey, Clay, if there was a summer camp for critical thinking, we'd be the chief counselors.
Those jellyheads in June would be intellectual warriors by August.
Be a lot of fun, too. Some Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure references thrown in.
This podcast, like a daily dose of that, minus the campfires, archery, and pranking the girls.
The bona fide boot camp for critical thinking. You can get in on it for free at the iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts. Just search our names, Clay and Buck, listen and subscribe.
This is the Jesse Kelly Show.
It is the Jesse Kelly Show. Final hour of the Jesse Kelly Show on a Memorial Day, honoring the fallen with all 3 hours today. No politics, no food talk, just history stories, reading the names of the fallen. In case you're just now joining us, I'm in the middle of a story about the Battle of Tsavo Island. So that's kind of what you missed. The Japanese or they've taken over a bunch of stuff in World War II. We're just now starting to fight back. We're trying to get into Guadalcanal. We get on Guadalcanal, and then the Navy has to take its aircraft carriers and leave because it's worried. And that's where we're going to get back to in a second. Let me read a couple more names here. Joseph W. Morrell, World War II Europe. Senior Airman Richard Galelli, training accident. Staff Sergeant Rusty Hunter Christian, KIA, Operation Enduring Freedom. We will continue on with those names and stories throughout the show until we finish here. Now let's go back to the Battle of Tsavo Island. So they drop our Marines at Guadalcanal, the aircraft carriers leave, and now our Marines don't have that much in the way of naval support, but there are still ships there, cruisers and things. We still have a Navy presence. And the naval ships that are there, they are definitely aware of their predicament. And here's their predicament. There's a place, it's called Rubal. Rubal. It was really Japanese Pacific headquarters during World War II. They built the thing up into being this juggernaut. That's where the Navy would go and refit and refuel. And the planes at Rubal was everything to them. The reason so many Americans don't know its name is we never invaded it. The reason we never invaded it was we ended up taking so much control of the sea that we figured it would be too hard to invade it. Just cut it off and let them all starve to death. And that's pretty much what we did. Anyway, but Rubal was still hot and heavy right now. They are going. And what's happening is the Japanese are close enough. Rubal is close enough that they're already launching air attacks from Rubal and they're reconning. So this is part of combat that we don't think about as much. It's very human nature not to think about this. Where are they? How many are there? These questions are always on people's minds, and we don't automatically know those things. Even today, with the planes and the satellites and the pictures and the internet, where's the enemy? How many of them are there? What kind of equipment do they have in the Pacific? Now, picture the Pacific Ocean. Just there's nothing out there, and then there's islands, and then there's nothing out there, and there's islands. You have to go find them. They're not radioing you ahead of time, letting you know where they are. The Japanese began to launch all kinds of reconnaissance planes from Rubal. What are we dealing with the Marines on the island? What are we dealing with as far as the Navy? What kind of ships do they have out there? And remember, just because you launch planes doesn't mean the planes will see them either. And that's going to come into play really here. Just because you're on a recon mission, whether you have a ship out there doing recon or a plane out there doing recon trying to find the enemy, just because you're doing one doesn't mean you're going to find them. The Pacific Ocean, all oceans, it is a huge place and you can lose entire fleets. You can go right, you can be within 20 miles of one and not see it. It's hard to find things in the ocean. Honestly, that survivors were ever found in World War II in the water, after they went in the water, that they found the USS Indianapolis guys at all is a miracle. It is. You don't find things. Anyway, so the Japanese, they're launching all these recons, and they figure out, hey, we have these Marines on Guadalcanal. Let's get them off Guadalcanal. They think they can fight the Marines off. And so they try to start reinforcing Guadalcanal. They're sending troops down there. Well, one of these troop transports the Japanese send has over 300 Japanese troops on it heading towards Guadalcanal. And it runs into a U.S. submarine it didn't know was there. Submarine, couple torpedoes into its side. 300 Japanese troops go to the bottom of the Pacific. They never get to Guadalcanal in order to reinforce their guys and fight the Marines off. All right. The Japanese have had about enough of this. They believe that they can wound the U.S. Navy and sweep us off the sea. Their goal is get our naval vessels that are parked outside of Guadalcanal, get them gone. And the Japanese were huge believers in surprise, ambush, night attacks. They were huge believers in decisive battles. They were so bold. Honestly, if it wasn't for their inhuman brutality during World War II, it would be hard not to just admire a lot of their military philosophy. They would take big, big, big chances. And here's what they decide to do. After the American carriers leave, now the Navy's sitting there. We lost the troop transport. What if we took a bunch of ships under one of our greatest generals? And what if we launched a surprise night attack against all the naval vessels that are left around Guadalcanal? After all, it's the U.S. Navy. We're better than them. They don't see it coming. So here's how we're going to set this up just in your mind. I know you're probably driving or cooking or working out or doing something. So I just want to do this image. If you have a piece of paper, you can write it down. If not, it's fine. Just do it in your head. So just draw a circle in the piece of paper. All right. You see that circle? There it is. Circle in your piece of paper. That's Guadalcanal. It's very much not shaped like that, I need to point out. But anyway, for our purposes, that's where it is. The top of the circle. Go up top. The northern part. That's the ocean. All right? I know it's an island. It's surrounded by ocean. Just stay with me. The northern part is the ocean where our Navy is patrolling. The Marines are on the northern part of Guadalcanal. The U.S. Navy is patrolling off of the Guadalcanal shores. Rubal, this big Japanese military base, as you're looking at the piece of paper, it's on your left. It's out west, okay? It's not critical that you understand that, but it will help kind of visualize where it's from. Rubal is west. There's Guadalcanal. We landed on the northern part of it, the top of it, and our Navy is patrolling on the top of that. Now, the Navy has to figure out, they have to figure out how they're going to secure this kind of an area so that they will know if the Japanese Navy is coming their way, if reinforcements are coming their way. How exactly do you go about that? You know, you can't just put your ships 10 miles offshore and park them all there. You've got to go out and you've got to look. You've got to go look for the enemy. You have to set up ships in little corridors where you think the enemy might come. You've got to figure this thing out. And this is, honestly, this is just some all-time bad luck occurs here. A couple different ways, some all-time bad luck here. One, we send the Australians. The Australians are part of this whole thing. We're working with their Navy, okay? We're working with the Australian Navy. We take the Australian dude and we send him west, all right? And we just send him west and we say, hey, Admiral Australian guy, good day, mate. You go west. Now, I'm not insulting them. The Australians were awesome in World War II. They're great fighters, great military history. You go to this little part out west and you give us a heads up if any of these Japanese Navy ships start coming our way. That's your job, is to patrol this area and watch, all right? So we send him west. And we send one of our guys, and again, just a little ship, we send him northwest. Hey, I believe he was in a destroyer. You go up there and watch, all right? So you with me? We have guys watching west. We have guys watching northwest. And then bad luck happens. And bad luck is just one of those things. So this Japanese admiral, he's leaving Rubal, and he's got these heavy cruisers and destroyers. He's got this little Navy attack ambush force. I want to make sure I give him credit where credit is due. He is a slick, smooth operator. He understands that there are U.S. attack subs in the area. He understands that there are American recon planes in the area. Some, not many, but there are some in the area. And he understands the element of surprise is critical. So he launches this little ambush at the right time. He does get a little bit of luck, courtesy of Mother Nature, where there was super low, thick cloud cover that day. So his little attack force is extremely hidden. And he understood where the patrols were, and he kind of did some pretty slick operating to avoid these patrols. But he is heading towards that Western patrol where the Australian admiral is. So why didn't the admiral intercept him in time? We'll talk about that next.
Truth. Attitude. Jesse Kelly.
It is the Jesse Kelly Show on a Memorial Day, telling about telling the story of the Battle of Tsavo Island, honoring the fallen as best we can all 3 hours today. A few more names for you. Captain Sean Patrick Grimes, Operation Iraqi Freedom. PFC James Edward Tobin, Korea. David Nelson Fox, Vietnam. We'll get to some more when we get back, some other things. We're going back to the Battle of Tsavo Island. I'm going to try to wrap this up here so I can tell a couple other little stories, some Air Force Cross, Citation, Silver Star stuff, some other cool things. But before I do that, so the Japanese, this admiral, he gets the advantage of low cloud cover, and he starts sailing towards the Americans, and he intends to ambush them off of Guadalcanal. Luck is just one of those things. Bad luck visits you when good luck visits you. The Australian admiral, who was sent to do the patrolling in the West so he would see any Japanese who were coming and give everyone a heads up, on the night he gets called to a meeting pulling him away from that area, that happens to be the night where the Japanese ambush is coming through. We pulled the admiral in charge of that particular area away for a matter of hours so he could come to a meeting to decide what to do next. And boom, the Japanese Navy goes cruising on by when he gets pulled off of his post. All-time bad luck. Now, the Japanese Navy has the element of surprise on their side. They have experience on their side. Our Navy is not experienced yet. We are very green, very fresh. And the Japanese, they train to fight at night. They're famous for this in World War II, both on the land and in the sea. They believe it gives them an advantage because they love fighting at night. They train to fight at night. Other people, other armies don't like to fight at night. They're always looking for any little advantage. Again, it's a really cool thing. They did this to the point where they had extreme testing for the eyesight of their people in the Navy and in the Army. And you had special postings if you could see better at night. They were obsessed with scopes who could see things at night. They would flare you. They would light you up. And this is what happens to this naval group just off the coast of Guadalcanal. Right as the Japanese are approaching, getting ready to ambush them in the inky black night of the Pacific Ocean, Japanese aircraft start dropping aircraft flares over the top of the U.S. Navy. So our Navy, now it's not as if our guys are sitting there picking their nose. They knew they could be in danger, but they had no idea. You would have no idea. And because the Australian guy got pulled off his post, no one told him it was coming. All of a sudden, it's the middle of the night and poof, your ship is lit up like a Christmas tree. And the Japanese Navy, who has trained for this, begins dumping ammunition into your sides, and U.S. sailors start dying. And again, I I have a lot of fun poking fun at the other services just because it's fun to do that. It makes me laugh, makes everyone laugh. Everyone enjoys it. Everyone who was in enjoys it. I have such an inhuman amount of respect for fighting Navy sailors, guys who've been in naval combat, because every part of it, I'll be honest with you, terrifies me to the point that I don't know that I could do it. When I say lit up in the middle of the night, how many sailors were asleep in the bowels of these ships when they were awakened to artillery shells blowing them up? How many guys died in the dark, burned to death, drowned? How many guys were blown off the ships, drowned in the water? Maybe the sharks got them. It was... Naval combat is so horrible. You're in a gigantic ball of shrapnel. That's all. It's all armor and steel and stuff that gets really hot. It blows up. It kills you. The ship is full of fuel. The ship is full of ammunition. And you're shooting at other ships, and they're shooting at you while you're doing this. The Southern group that gets ambushed right here takes a beating. And you should feel really good about yourself, though, because while we did, most definitely, we lacked experience. At this point in the war, the Japanese Navy was better. They had better commanders, more experience. Their ships were great and things like that. But be very, very proud of yourself if you're an American, because the Americans, they may have lacked the skill, but they did not lack the grit. While we were taking a beating from these things, we were hitting back with everything we've got. Everything we've got, we're launching it back. And the Japanese, they're taking hits too. Now, they're not taking the hits we're taking. They have all the initiative. They had everything was on their side. They are brutalizing us. I don't want to act like, oh, it could have gone either way. No. We got our butts kicked really bad. But they dive in on the Southern group. They essentially wipe out the Southern group. And they know there's a northern group that's a little further north off Guadalcanal. They turn and head towards the northern group because they're going to make this a twofer. While they still have the advantage of the darkness in the night, they're going to go dive onto the northern group and see if they can't sweep the Navy off the seas. I'll tell you what happens next. Next.
Feeling a little stocky? Follow, like, and subscribe on social at Jesse Kelly DC.
It is the Jesse Kelly Show on a Memorial Day. Finishing up the story now of the Battle of Tsavo Island, and then I'll get to a couple more of these citations before we leave here, and I'll leave you to the week, and I'll be back in a week. So, Battle of Tsavo Island, Japanese Navy just ambushed a group of our naval vessels and beat them up very, very badly. And then they turn north because they're going to go attack the northern group and attempt to finish us off. Now, I'm not going to name his name because I feel horrible for the guy. The southern group commander, for whatever reason, and I don't know the reasons, I dug into a lot of it yesterday, trying to come up with some sort of an explanation, and I didn't get one. Maybe he was confused. Maybe he was sick. I don't know. But he gets ambushed by this Japanese group that beats him up badly. And he doesn't relay the information to the northern group. He doesn't tell anyone. He just got ambushed by this Japanese Navy group that nobody knew that were there, and he doesn't tell anybody. And the reason I'm not going to say his name is he was so torn up with guilt after this that a couple months later he committed suicide and he killed himself. He couldn't live with himself after what he'd done or didn't do. You know, that's part of combat too. Either way, they get to the northern group. And because no one had told them they were coming, again, the Japanese had the element of surprise on their side. And they, again, beat our guys up. And once again, I need to clarify, the bravery of the U.S. Navy when they were taking this beating, it was amazing. Some of these ships, one ship in particular, it was pretty much done for. It was on fire and probably going to sink. and the ship still turned into the Japanese convoy just so they could fire some more shots at them as they were going down into the water. Really just grit, an admirable amount of grit. No, we got guns too. It was awesome. It was amazing. But we lost, and we lost badly. Badly. Men are dying, men are burning, men are drowning in the middle of the night in the Pacific. By the grace of God, the Japanese, they got worried about daylight coming. They got worried about American reinforcements. You know, you never know where the other guy is. They didn't have a transponder letting them know that the rest of our Navy was off somewhere. So this admiral decides he's not going to press his luck and he's going to leave. Well, remember how I was talking about luck and all-time bad luck? And remember how I was talking about the different patrols that were out there? And I told you there was this destroyer in the Northwest, and his job was just to kind of patrol and make sure the Japanese never attacked. Well, as the Japanese leave, they run into this poor destroyer who's just out on patrol, has no idea what's going on, has no idea the Japanese are even there. He's by himself, and the Japanese ambush patrol happens to basically trip on him on the way back to Rubal, their base. And of course, they just blow him right out of the water too. Now, I do want to put one little good bow on this story before we honor the rest of these Navy guys that fell and whatnot. The Japanese didn't have all the good luck in the Battle of Tsavo Island. They did happen to run into a U.S. submarine they didn't know was there on their way back, and this submarine sent a Japanese naval vessel to the bottom of the Pacific Ocean with the torpedo. So believe me, we got some of ours. But the Battle of Tsavo Island was horrific in so many ways, and if you've ever seen, the miniseries The Pacific, when they land on Guadalcanal, and there's a couple scenes, I haven't seen it in a while, but they essentially wake up one day and the Navy's gone. Then the Marines on Guadalcanal, they just landed there and they're looking around and, hey, where are the support vessels? Where's our food? Where's everything? Well, the Battle of Tsavo Island swept the Navy off the seas and around Guadalcanal. This Battle of Tsavo Island is the reason the Marines were left on Guadalcanal without any support at all. And, you know, again, we talked about that last hour when we were talking about the Civil War. Those are 17-year-olds, 18-year-olds. I'm 42 years old. Here I am today, 42 years old. Got a job I love, family I love, 42. 17, 18, they gave all that up and they died in the dark waters of the Pacific that long ago. They gave all that up. And I just think that is, I don't know, I find it very hard to know the best way to honor them, to be honest with you. I think it is so sad but awesome and admirable that these men, I mean, all of them, that they've given up so much for us. PFC Michael Metcalf, Operation Enduring Freedom. Zachary Golly, EOD training accident. Staff Sergeant Albert Hoover, plane malfunction. They give up so much. And you know what? Let's do a couple other readings here before we check out, because there are a couple other things I want to get to. Someone sent this one in, Captain Edward Ewan, November 2004. In January of 2004, Ed was deployed to Iraq. In the spring and summer of 2004, Task Force 22 Infantry that Ed was part of fought in several cities, including Bakuba, Mosul, and Maqdiya. During the summer of 2004, Ed was promoted to Executive Officer of Company A. For those who don't know, that means he's the second in charge of Alpha Company, Company A. He's big time. On November 5th, 2004, Ed's infantry company moved to Camp Fallujah to take part in the Battle of Fallujah, also called Operation Phantom Fury. On November 12th, Ed's task force found itself in the middle of a complex ambush. Ed was fatally injured when his Bradley fighting vehicle was struck by a rocket-propelled grenade. Ron Camarda was with Ed at Surgical Bravo, anointed him with holy oils. Father Ron Camarda anointed him with holy oils and sang, "O Holy Night, as life as we know it," left him. Ed was awarded the Purple Heart and Bronze Star for his actions. He was also promoted to captain after his death. These are the stories we have to tell. Here's this guy, Air Force Cross, Vietnam. President of the United States of America, authorized by Title 10, Section 8742, United States Code, takes pride in presenting the Air Force Cross posthumously to Captain Charles Edwin Engel, United States Air Force Reserve, for extraordinary heroism in military operations against an opposing armed force as forward air controller and pilot of an 01 aircraft of the 56th Special Operations Wing, Udorn Royal Thai Air Base, Thailand, in action in Southeast Asia on the 20th of July, 1970. On that date, while attempting to pinpoint a downed pilot's location, Captain Engel's aircraft was met with a hail of gunfire which severed the fuel line, drenching the aircraft and the pilot. With complete disregard for his own safety, Captain Engel continued his efforts to suppress ground fire positions. When the pilot was located, a pickup was attempted. During the attempt, the rescue aircraft helicopter received heavy automatic weapons fire. Realizing that the rescue aircraft was in extreme danger of being shot down, Captain Engel, again with complete disregard for his own safety, dove his aircraft between the gun position and the helicopter, thereby allowing the helicopter to safely break away. After the ground fire was suppressed, other aircraft moved in for a successful pickup. Through his extraordinary heroism, superb airmanship, and aggressiveness in the face of the enemy, Captain Engel reflected the highest credit upon himself and the United States Air Force. We have one segment left, and then we're leaving, okay? Hang on.
I've got an animal inside of me.
This is Jesse Kelly. You're listening to The Jesse Kelly Show.
It is the Jesse Kelly Show, final segment of the Jesse Kelly Show on a very special, very sacred Memorial Day, as every Memorial Day is. Today is the day just to honor the fallen and the families they leave behind. We don't do politics this day. We don't take the day off. We don't do ads. This is just a day to honor the fallen. We don't do another show all year like this day. And it's just something we want to do. So we're going to read a few things here as we finish this up. A few Silver Stars, Distinguished Service things, as much as I can possibly fit in before we leave. This one is a Patrick Brian Olson, Air Force, Gulf War, February 1991. Silver Star. The President of the United States of America, authorized by Act of Congress July 9th, 1918, takes pride in presenting the Silver Star posthumously to Captain Patrick Brian Olson, United States Air Force, for gallantry in action while engaged in military operations involving conflict with an armed hostile force, in action as pilot of an OA-10 Thunderbolt, in action against Iraq and Kuwait Theater of Operations, Operation Desert Storm, on the 27th of February, 1991. While attacking the Medina Division of the Republican Guard, Lieutenant Olson's aircraft sustained severe battle damage. With the complete loss of hydraulic pressure, he transitioned to manual reversion flight controls and maneuvered his crippled aircraft back to friendly territory. Captain Olson lost his life on landing while attempting to save a valuable aircraft. By his gallantry and devotion to duty and dedication of his service to his country, Captain Olson has reflected great credit upon himself and upheld the highest traditions of the United States Air Force. It's another thing we don't talk about when it comes to pilots and air crew. How dangerous of a job it is. Flying's dangerous enough. Flying when people are shooting at you, mechanical failure, things are going wrong. Every time these guys get in those planes and go up, whether it's in training or combat, it might be their last time. You want to read heartbreaking stories? Read stories. Speaking of the ball gunner, we've told these stories before. Ball gunner, B-17, the hydraulic lines get shot out so he can't move the ball. Therefore, he can't get out of the ball because there was only one position where you could get out of it and get up into the plane, and the ship's plane's landing gear won't go down. So he knows when he lands, he's going to get mashed into a pancake. He knows this. For hours, he's flying home knowing he's dead. What are those moments like? What's that like? Golly. The President of the United States of America takes pride in presenting the Silver Star posthumously to Staff Sergeant Ryan Augusto Tejada, United States Marine Corps, for conspicuous gallantry and intrepidity in action against the enemy as Platoon Sergeant, 2nd Platoon, Company K, 3rd Battalion, 5th Marines, Regional Combat Team 5, 1st Marine Division, 1st Marine Expeditionary Force in support of Operation Enduring Freedom and Iraqi Freedom from the 21st of March to the 11th of April 2003. Staff Sergeant Tejada aggressively and fearlessly led his Marines, on the 3rd of April 2003, his company came under intense small arms fire from entrenched Republican Guard positions outside the city of Al-Izayah. With complete disregard for his personal safety, Staff Sergeant Tejada exposed himself to enemy fire and charged into the enemy fortifications, leading his platoon's assault on enemy positions. He single-handedly cleared one position, killing two Republican Guard soldiers. He then led a fire team to destroy a second enemy position on the 11th of April 2003 while conducting a foot mobile combat patrol in the district of Baghdad. His platoon was ambushed from multiple directions with small arms and rocket-propelled grenades. Taking charge at the head of the formation, he inspired his Marines and directed them to positions to counter the enemy's attack. While bravely leading and fighting beside his Marines, he was struck by enemy fire and mortally wounded. By his bold leadership, wise judgment, and complete dedication to duty, Staff Sergeant Tejada reflected great credit upon himself and upheld the highest traditions of the Marine Corps and the U.S. Naval Service. And I will tell you this from people who know, that was a full-grown man right there. That was a man. He was an awesome Marine. Semper Fi, brother. This one's from Richard Dick Bong, Army Air Force, World War II, Pacific. 8 days before Japan's surrender. For conspicuous gallantry, this is a Medal of Honor, and intrepidity in action above and beyond the call of duty, in the Southwest Pacific area from the 10th of October to the 15th of November 1944. Though assigned to duty as gunnery instructor and neither required nor expected to perform combat duty, Major Bong voluntarily and at his own urgent request engaged in repeated combat missions, including unusually hazardous sorties over Borneo and in the Leyte area of the Philippines. His aggressiveness and daring resulted in his shooting down 8 enemy planes during this period. I could read Silver Stars. I mean, look, I'll just do another one here. One more. Hermann Johann Friedrich Boucher, President of the United States of America, authorized by Act of Congress, July 9th, 1918, takes pleasure in presenting the Distinguished Service Cross to Captain, then Staff Sergeant, Hermann Boucher, U.S. Army, for extraordinary heroism in connection with military operations against an armed enemy while serving with the 126th Infantry Division, 36th Infantry Division, in action against enemy forces from the 5th to the 11th of December, 1942, in the vicinity of Buna, New Guinea. During an attack on enemy positions, Captain Boucher led a unit which cut off communications between Japanese garrisons at Buna and Buna's Mission Government Station. Later, during a simultaneous attack by both enemy garrisons, Captain Boucher calmly stood up and threw hand grenades at the advancing troops. Although wounded in this action, he stayed with his unit until relieved. His outstanding leadership and personal heroism repeatedly inspired his men and was primarily responsible for the success of their defense and exemplified the highest traditions of the military forces of the United States and reflect great credit upon himself, the 32nd Infantry Division, and the United States Army. And to that gentleman and every man and woman who has given their life on behalf of this country. We pray for your families that you leave behind. We just want to say thank you. There's nothing else to say. Nothing else is worth saying, but thank you. Thank you for what you gave up for this country. That's all.
Hey, Clay, if there was a summer camp for critical thinking, we'd be the chief counselors.
Those jellyheads in June would be intellectual warriors by August.
Be a lot of fun, too. Some Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure references thrown in.
This podcast, like a daily dose of that, minus the campfires, archery, and pranking the girls.
The bona fide boot camp for critical thinking. You can get in on it for free at the iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts. Just search our names, Clay and Buck, listen and subscribe.